Welcome to That Is Good to Know Radio Show. This program focuses on you, the listener, by providing you information, strategies, and practical educational tips from successful seasoned business professionals. Now, with today's program, here's your host, Jeff Stanislow.
Hello, and welcome to That Is Good to Know with your host, Jeff Stanislow. Hello, Tampa. We're having a great day today. We have a special guest joining us. It is Heather DeGrave from Walters, Levine, and DeGrave. Good morning to you, Heather.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. So I had an opportunity to talk to Stuart Levine from your firm a little while back, and Stuart recommended that I have you on today to talk a little bit further and share some knowledge with the greater Tampa Bay area about contract law. He says you're an expert in it. He says smartest person that he knows. And so I'm glad that he got an opportunity to spend some time with you today.
Yeah, great. Absolutely.
So before we get started, why don't you give me a little bit of background on you? You know, how long you've been an attorney and how long you've been with the firm and in Tampa, and kind of let's set the stage for our discussion this morning.
Yeah, so I have been an attorney since 2004, and I have been with the firm Walters, Levine, and DeGrave since 2004. I started here as what they call a baby attorney, and I've grown up through the ranks, grown up in my practice, working with Stuart and through this firm.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. You know, oftentimes a lot of people are moving around a lot more nowadays. And so, you know, right out of law school into Walters, Levine, and DeGrave. And congratulations on sticking that through and reaping the rewards with it.
Yeah, thank you. It's been an honor.
Yeah, so we're here at their beautiful offices in downtown Tampa. And enjoying, our conversation. Tell us a little bit about, where'd you go to law school? You said, I think we talked earlier, you said you went to Georgetown.
Yeah, so I went to Georgetown from 2001 to 2004. That was right there in the heart of D.C. The law school is actually not in Georgetown. It's closer to the Capitol building and the courthouses. So I would go to class and then I would walk down to the mall, where the Lincoln Memorial is, the Washington Monument, and I would do my studies on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. So it was a lot of fun.
Fantastic. That's incredible. Tell us what it was like about being so close to, our capital and going to law school. Is it more motivational for you? Was it just inspiring?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, it gives you a lot of opportunities. I actually had the opportunity to intern with the representative from Congress who represented the area where I was living at the time. So I was able to intern with her office for a semester and, you know, walk from the law school to the Capitol and through the Capitol to the office building and get to be part of the workings of the nation. And it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So you came down to Tampa. I mean, what was the opportunity? You were there in Georgetown, you were there where all the laws and lawmakers are. What brought you down to Tampa?
Well, it was family. My husband was living here and he was part of a family business. And so here I am. And I've been here since, I've lived here since 2000 and then been practicing as a lawyer here since 2004.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, we appreciate you spending some time here with us today. You're listening to Jeff Stanislow, the host of That Is Good to Know. And we're talking with Heather DeGrave from Walters, Levine, and DeGrave. And today we're going to just talk about entering into contracts, contract law. We all sign contracts throughout our lives. And that has changed in itself. We used to have wet signatures and paper documents to review in many situations. But a lot of it now is click to accept these terms and sign here with a electronic signature. Just tell us a little bit about, the kind of the difference or the technology side or what you've seen transpire in law when it comes down to enacting a contract.
Well, it's interesting. With the changing technology, the law on contracts hasn't necessarily changed as much as how it applies to our day-to-day lives has changed. At the heart of a contract is an exchange between two people, two entities, something. You know, I'm willing to exchange something, and in return, you're willing to exchange something to me. And how that is memorialized has changed with the technology. You know, you have a written contract with terms and conditions. Now when you're clicking, you're not necessarily looking at terms and conditions, but they're there and they are enforceable, whether or not you bother to click the link that says read these terms and conditions, or even if you've clicked the link and you just scroll through to get to the end, you are still charged with having read and understood and agreed with all the terms and conditions. And so that aspect of the law, that you're bound by it if you sign it, has remained the same, you know, for hundreds of years. It's just that now it's even easier for us to agree to those without actually having read them.
I know. I read somewhere that it's like less than 0.5% of people actually look through the terms and conditions on things that they're signing or committing to in regards to this technology age. How has that changed for you being a lawyer when helping to draft a contract or put this together? Has it given a lot more breadth for you to put more information, in essence, protecting your client in these terms and conditions, just because of the electronic nature and people scrolling through them and then just clicking the button and moving on?
Yes, absolutely. You definitely want to, when you're working with your client on drafting contracts, to include language that says, you know, to the effect, notwithstanding that these are entered into electronically, you're still bound by them. You, by clicking here, you acknowledge that you are still bound by them. Absolutely.
Now, how about the electronic signature part of this? We're talking with Heather DeGrave, partner at Walters Levine and DeGrave here in Tampa, doing some wonderful law work. And we'll put some information up on our website, thatisgoodtoknow.com, with Heather's links. And so you can reach out to her and we'll have her share some contact information shortly. But just talk to me about the electronic signature. You know, kind of, you know, early on, there was probably arguments about electronic signatures not being valid, and today they are. Simply put, you know, if you're using an electronic signature or acknowledging something, you are responsible for those terms or your end of the bargain. But tell us a little bit about, you've probably kind of lived through that where it was not a valid, and now it is valid, and kind of when did that really kind of take place? Was there any particular law or precedence that was set that really defined that?
Well, the law, especially here in Florida, had been heading in that direction for several years. And I think COVID only made it all the more necessary to actually get it in place and actually make it fully enforceable. And so you see recent changes in the last few years, not just with electronic signatures, but also with online notarization of those electronic signatures those online acceptances of those electronic signatures. With respect to the electronic signatures, whether it be that I could just type my name, does that count as an electronic signature? Or whether I need to have a scanned copy of my signature that then I attach to a document, that's changed over the years. You know, and now a lot of times all you have to do is type your name, and that's considered electronic signature. You know, but taking into account how we can document that and how we can track that to make sure that it actually is the person signing who says they're signing. That's what's changed over the years, and I think for the better.
Yeah, and services like DocuSign have emerged. It's right. Very commonplace. You know, usually probably early on in its days, it was, you know, for larger law firms or, you know, larger, you know, type transactions. But today, DocuSign is used on, you know, I have a DocuSign account for a simple little contract and can send it over and people can make changes and revise drafts. How much has that technology or that application side helped you being a lawyer, you know, focus more on good lawyering versus, you know, chasing around contracts and signatures and things of that nature?
Well, you know, in my practice, litigation especially, everything is deadline driven. And so we're always pushing up against the deadline. And that's only made it easier to make sure that we meet those deadlines, that we're not worried about getting this person's wet signature and then scanning it in and then making sure that it's filed with the clerk's office before 5 p.m. You know, it gives us a little more leeway to make sure that we get the job done right rather than just on time. So it's definitely helped in that regard. With respect to DocuSign, I will say that I have noticed, though, that even with technology like DocuSign, you still see it play out, for instance, in real estate transactions. You know, a lot of times the DocuSign will be used to enter into the original purchase agreement, or and several things along the way that you're asked, you're emailed a document, please sign here, and you sign here, and it can timestamp when you've signed it. But then when it comes down to the actual closing, still a lot of banks are wanting you to be in person. They want to see the wet signature. So it hasn't completely gone the way of electronic signatures, but several steps in the process have gone that way.
So there's been efficiencies in regards to the process for sure. But depending on, the situation, there still may require wet signatures or someone to be, prove who they are before they sign.
Right. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Very good. This is Jeff Stanislow, and you're listening to That Is Good to Know. And we are talking with Heather DeGrave, a partner at Walters, Levine & DeGrave here in Tampa. Taking a step back, Heather, tell us a little bit about the firm and what you guys do and what you specialize in.
Sure. So we are a full service business law firm. We represent businesses who need to handle disputes and resolutions with other businesses. We provide all manners of service, including litigation, a lot of construction litigation, commercial collections litigation, just general business-to-business litigation, and as well as shareholder disputes, that sort of thing. But then we also provide ancillary services, including real estate work. We do estate planning, business asset planning services, anything that a business, in particular a small business, may need in order to service them in the legal world.
Sure. And you have offices here in Tampa, and yep. Then you have in Sarasota as well?
As well, right. Okay. So we operate primarily out of those two offices, our Sarasota office and our Tampa office, and I'm here in the Tampa office. But we also have a nationwide presence. We have connections with law firms around the country. I represent some clients who have a need for legal services around the country, and I assist in obtaining those legal services for them, as well as we have a statewide presence. We are all admitted to practice in all of the courts of the state of Florida and in the federal courts as well.
Fantastic. And this is Jeff Stanislow. This is That Is Good to Know. We're going to put information up on our guest, Heather DeGrave, partner at Walters, Levine, and DeGrave. We'll put her information on thatisgoodtoknow.com. And you can also do a quick Google search for Walters, Levine, and DeGrave, or Walters and Levine. It'll pop up here in Tampa. And you can also search for her. She's on LinkedIn. You can search for Heather DeGrave. Heather, again, diving back into the contract, what are the principles of a contract, and what are the kind of meat and potatoes? You mentioned earlier that it's just an agreement between two parties for an exchange of services or products or goods. But, diving a little bit and breaking out the contract itself, can you tell us what are some of the main components of a contract?
Sure. And it's kind of funny that sometimes you'll see contracts and they actually don't include some of these what are called material terms. So those terms that are so essential that you either, if they're not there, you don't have a contract. And what's interesting is that sometimes you'll see contracts that don't have those material terms. So when you're talking about providing services or selling a product, you might see a contract that has all of the details on how much you're going to pay, how you make the payment, when the payment must be made. And yet when you look at it, you don't see what the other side is providing in return. It's almost that it's assumed, because they're a service provider of a certain type, that they're going to provide that service in exchange, but it's not actually well-defined in the contract. And so that's something that you, when you're entering into a contract, you want to look and see, are the services, are the products that are going to be provided, are they well-defined? And then conversely, the payment terms, is that well-defined? Do we know exactly how the payment's going to be calculated? Do we know when it needs to be made? Do we know where it needs to be made? These are some essential terms that I think people think, well, we have an understanding. Well, if it's not in the contract, it's not necessarily part of the contract. And so you need to make sure that those are set out in the contract.
And that's oftentimes where disputes occur from, when it's not defined in the contract properly. And one like assumes that, hey, I purchased this service and, you know, I made my payments, but then I thought the service included this, but it didn't. And you start diving into the contract and, you know, hence that's when, you know, usually you get a phone call from someone.
Right.
Say, can you help understand this contract? Because I thought I was getting this. And then you, you know, help them navigate that contract.
Right, right. And you don't want to be relying on a lawyer and case law and a judge to be interpreting the terms of the contract. You want, you know, as much as I would love to serve you and litigate that issue, the reality is that you want to know from the beginning what you're getting, and you want it to be spelled out in writing.
Yeah, certainly times. I mean, like if someone's authoring, let's talk about authoring a contract. So, you know, a small business owner, you know, wants to provide a service. And, you know, we talk about these material terms that need to be defined. How do you advise them and, you know, go through like your game planning for helping someone to write a contract?
Well, you know, there are a lot of, you know, if you've been in business any length of time, you've seen certain contracts. And so there's no shame in borrowing from those, especially ones that have worked well for you or ones that haven't worked well for you, and you've learned your lessons on how you would change the wording in the future. There's certainly no harm, no shame in that. But in terms of that, you want to make sure that your client from the beginning is fully aware of what they're providing and what they're receiving in exchange. And you want that even before the contract is drafted, you want as much of that spelled out in writing, whether it be by email or by letter, you know, letter of intent or whatever. You want as much of that as possible spelled out in writing so that there aren't, you know, issues down the line as you're authoring the contract of, wait, that wasn't what I agreed.
So if there is a dispute, how oftentimes, you know, are people able to kind of work this out? Is it usually, you know, clarification from a client to the service provider of the details? Do you have to create an addendum? You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, remedies available that, you know, most people can do between themselves.
Yeah. And actually that's something that you want to work into the contract. And you brought up sort of two areas that actually would be two different sections of a contract. One is changes, amendments to the contract. What is the process for entering into those? Construction contracts in particular, you know, have a change order process, and it needs to be spelled out when there is a lack of information. How do we get more information? What kind of request for information are we allowed to ask for? What kind of equitable adjustment is available? And then what are the processes for if we need to change the scope of work or change the amount of payment for an additional scope of work? How do we go about entering into that process? And so you'll want to look to see what are the provisions that's set forth how you would amend a contract. And then the second thing that you brought up is what I would call the termination provisions of a contract. And in the event of a violation of the material terms of the contract, how can that be addressed? You know, is it that there is a dispute process that you can raise either with a neutral that you both agree to in advance, or a process for choosing a neutral, or even just working it out between yourselves? Is there a dispute resolution process? And then barring that, is there a way that we can end this contractual relationship if we reach a point that we're just not, we're no longer in agreement with how we're going to proceed forward?
Yes, this is Jeff Stanislow, and you're listening to That Is Good to Know. I think we're sharing some great information for everybody out there in the greater Tampa area to, you know, to learn, and hopefully when they're done listening to the show, they say, hey, that was really good to know. And our guest today is Heather DeGrave from the firm Walters, Levine, and DeGrave. So we talked a little bit about neutral party, is that the same thing as mitigation? Or, you know, talk to us a little bit about the difference between that and what does a mitigator do, or, you know, someone that, you know, kind of helps bridge these gaps before you have to go to court or to trial?
And in the court system, there's this term called alternative dispute resolution, and it sort of encompasses all of what we're talking about here. There can be informal negotiations between the parties, and there can be set forth in writing how we would go about doing that and how we would raise that, just those informal negotiations. There could also be something a little more formal with what's known as a mediator. And the mediator is not a judge, and their whole purpose is to see if they can facilitate a resolution between the disputing parties. And they would, you know, and it can be any sort of process, whether you have a formal mediation where everyone sits down in a room together and sees what they can hash out, or whether you have a back and forth over telephone, over Zoom, whatever. And then you would bring in that neutral party, that mediator, to see if they can facilitate a resolution. And then oftentimes the next step, whether it be before litigation or instead of litigation, would be what's known as arbitration. And that's where you would bring in a neutral, either, you know, usually it's either one arbitrator or maybe a panel of three arbitrators, and you would bring them in and they would assess.